Old Queen Victoria came over here in 1903. And I remember standing up on the hill at Sea Point. Ardennes Terrace, it was a big hill at the end of it, and you could see right over into the harbour at Dunleary, do you see? And I remember her coming in, do you see? There was millions, there were millions and millions down there. What I mostly remember was we went up to the top of Sea Point Avenue, and we saw the whole procession of the Queen coming in from Dunleary, do you see? She was a very old woman then, and all the cavalry and everything, you know, I can remind it now, a magnificent sight, and the cavalry's helmets were shone like silver, you know, and the brass parts were like gold, and the way the horses, of course, the horses were magnificent. They were nearly in step. They were so well trained that you nearly saw them all rising up and down like that, you see, instead of just jumping up and down. You know what I mean? There was a lot of unison in it. And of course, at the corner there, it was the old tram stables. Do you see? Then they brought her into Dublin Castle. Of course, as I say, she was very old at the time, and she didn't remember things at all. Do you see? But to tell a great story about her. Anyway, they got her into Dublin Castle, into the royal rooms, do you see? And she had her dinner, I suppose, and everything else. And came to time to put her to bed, do you see? And when she woke up in the morning, she looked round at the room. And she says to her lady in waiting, or whatever you call them, "Where am I? Where am I? Where am I? Oh, madam, you're in the royal quarters of Dublin Castle." And she said for a moment, "And who? What bloody idiot brought me over here?" And now this reminds me of a naughty story. You can take this as a naughty story or as you like. Of old Lady Aberdeen. She was a terrible old bee. But they went away for their holidays, do you see? As they usually did every year. And when they were away, of course, all the rooms were redecorated. Everything was redecorated for them, do you see? And they came back, I don't know what it was, they came back a day before, or a couple of days before they were due, do you see? And they were only finishing off the bedrooms, do you see? And one morning, she came out of her bedroom, do you see, and looked down the hall, and there was a painter, you know. He said, "Come here, my man, come here, my man, come here, my man." And he says, you know, frightened as hell, you know, yes, ma'am, you know what they're doing, this kind of thing. "Come here, my man, I want to show you where his lordship put his hand last night." It was on the paint, you know, the paintwork was all wet. And you know what he said? His answer was, I'd soon have a bottle of stout, ma'am.
History is a funny thing. It tries, according to the scholars, to be accurate and unbiased and complete. But the vast majority of us see what we see and hear what we hear. And no amount of scholarly research will ever convince us that things were otherwise. The history of our own times, in particular, is a mixture of our own faulty information, incomplete facts, rumour, anecdotes, and propaganda which at a later stage we would perhaps have discounted, but were then disposed to believe. Alf Mackenzie was 3 years old at the turn of the 20th century. He has, as we all do, a selective, and as some of us would like to have, a highly varied, and as his friends know, a racy and humorous set of recollections of his times and the events that touched him. And people too, the people we read of in the history books, but seen in a different, perhaps more human light.
It was during the tram strike, anyway, and Larkin was going to have a huge meeting in O'Connell Street. And, of course, the police and everything were drafted in from England. So that he'd never get to O'Connell Street. So all of a sudden, in the Shelburne, the Gresham Hotel, a fellow walked out on the balcony, and there it was Larkin. But he was dressed as a priest. You see, he'd got through the whole crowd dressed as a priest, and he swore he'd be there, and they swore he wouldn't. But the transport in those days was more efficient than it is today. And the transport today is chaos compared to what it was in those days. The trams, this fast tram that left Dorking at 9 o'clock, or at 8:30, do you see, and it only took a half an hour to go into town. And we had to be in Blackrock College at 9 o'clock. But the driver and the driver of the tram, we'd get up the top of Belgrave Square and wait there. And he'd slow right down. And we'd get on the tram, do you see? And then when we came to Blackrock, though they stopped in Blackrock, when we came to Blackrock College, he slowed right down so as we got off. He didn't stop, but you see, it slowed to such a way that it would only just go like that, you see. Then those are kind of the little things that remained in my mind. Another time, the exhibition in 1907. My father was one of the people that got us up, you know, and then presented Herbert Park to the Ballsbridge Corporation. It was a corporation then, you see. It's only later on that it was incorporated in Dublin. It was the last day of the exhibition, do you see, and the brother wanted to get out, do you see, and he couldn't get a message, because there was very, very few phones in those days. He said to me, he said, "See here, Alf, I'll give you a shilling," and I know a shilling in those days was Christ almighty, it was wealth. If he says, sneak out and take this letter home to mother. So I got my mum and I got out of the side door of Blackrock College, and I got the letter to mother, and I was caught coming back in again, you see. And I was locked up before the prefect. I said, you're not going to flog me for it, or I'm not going to let you. And I got behind the bedwood chair and I said, now you come near me and I'll brain you with this bloody chair. You know, I met him years after down in Bray. I'd been married now about 4 years, you see. And he reminded me of the story, you see, the whole thing. I was going to brain him with the chair. So I was sent home, expelled, as it was.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, it's really not enough. She has nice hands to give the wretched girl her due, but don't you think her bust is too...
Oh, the Theatre Royal was smashing. So was all that. I was just talking about those theatres the other day, the Olympia, and then there was a little theatre in Brunswick Street. What's this they're called? But it always went in for these thrillers, you know, the bad landlord, you know, that thing. He's going to throw them out on the street, you see, or he was trying to rape the daughter or some damn thing, you know. That's the background, and I'm not telling you what, but. I remember one time there was I'll never forget this one. There was one play on there, and it was the title of it was "The Face of the Window," and it was on. It was threepence to get in. Threepence to get in, and then we had to get twopence to. Return ticket from Seapoint Station, because we were living there, to Weston Row. So you had to have about sixpence or sevenpence. And now this is before the First World War. And sixpence or sevenpence was a hell of a lot of money. I'm telling you, it was a hell of a lot of money. You walk around and you jingle that in your pocket, you were a walking bloody millionaire. But we used to always go when we get one of these things, and then there were ones up in the gods. It gets so excited at the play. Maybe the building would be creeping in you know. Onto a character or something, and he creeping in, looking all around and seeing that he wasn't being followed, and you'd hear all the other ones shouting, "He's at your back! He's at your back! He's at your back!" An awful lot of the grain ships came into Dublin, you see, from Australia, you see, instead of getting there. Down round the south of England where the subs were. They came up the centre of the Atlantic and then pulled into Ireland. And you see, they came to Dublin because it was easy just to reship it across to Holyhead or to Liverpool. But it took this one that I'm talking about was a sailing ship, you know, one of those big, huge sailing ships carrying about 3,000 to 5,000 tons of grain. And the old captain was an old roué, but he'd been at sea for 6 months. And the first night, the first day he arrived, you see, he was up in the office. And he wanted £8,000. So that was all right. That was no trouble. But the trouble was, somebody had to take him out that night, and the other two brothers wouldn't touch him with a, or three brothers wouldn't touch him with a bloody 40-foot pole. And of course, it came on to me. And the old Red Bank was in existence in those days. So we went to the Red Bank. And I had a few jars and had our dinner. And I was coming up to about 9 o'clock then. He says, is there any theatre we can go to? And of course there was the Tivoli. And we could only get a box, you see, and it was on the second floor. Well, in those days, you see, the women were all bums and bosoms. You see, that's the way they made themselves up. They got the bosom well out, the bum well out, with the corset, you know. So we went to the theatre, and the usual old vaudeville shows were on. And of course, now when I mentioned this fella had been at sea for six months, I wanted to, you'll get the gist of the story. So out came an actress singing, do you see? And she had a great big bosom and a great big backside on her. And she was singing one of these, I forget, you know, operatic songs, do you see? And the old captain, when he saw it, his eyes nearly came out of his head. The bosom, do you see? She came to go, you know, which gliding across the bloody stage, you know, singing and not to anybody, and you know, to the crowd. And she came to underneath our box and was singing out to the crowd. She was singing up, and here was a old captain hanging over the side of the box. Do you know what the next thing happened? He fell off the box into the stage. The Rising took place in 1916, you see. Well, I'd left school then, and I was with Keenan Company, the Chartered Accountants. I was an apprentice there. And that was the funniest place. The whole damn lot of the fellas in it were all in the IRA, and there were soldiers in it too. And the top office, it was in Dame Street, the Law Union office, of course. We had the whole offices. The top office, the desks and everything were filled with rifles. So you never saw anything like it. We were afraid of, good God, if we'd have been raided, we'd have been all taken in. But I used to bring the letters which were given in at the office. I used to take them up. I used to dress myself up in white spats and a little grey cane, you know, it's that age, do you see? And of course, the Black and Tans senior teacher would nearly roar laughing in your face. But I was carrying the dispatches up to the to I had his name in my house. McBride. That's what I used to do. I used to go out at 11 o'clock. On old Buckley. One day he came up. He never used to come up. He came up to the top office, do you see? And he was looking for something. And he opened the desk and he nearly dropped dead. With the guns and ammunition and everything in it. And then he went round the place. He says, "Christ almighty, is this the bloody Sinn Féin joint?" I was the only one there. I don't know, sir. I've never looked in those desks in my life. I only used my own, and there's nothing in it.
By the mid-20s, Alf, whose family were in a fair way of business in Dublin, as we've heard, was established as an accountant, not by any means the most popular trade in Ireland at the time. Like many another, and indeed many a poorer man before and after him, he made for the New World to make his fortune.
You know, in America is so egotistical. They couldn't believe that anything could happen to him. You know, what way would I put it there? That they were financially and everything so strong that the rest of the world would go, but never New York. But New York went bad. I don't suppose you ever heard of the penny dinners here. Well, they had the same kind of thing there. Oh, it was very bad. Very bad. There's an awful lot of fellas going round with hardly any shoes on them. They were right bad. And asking for dimes for everybody to get a cup of coffee or something like that. Oh, no. Then, of course, it was when the market crashed. Oh, jeepers, they were jumping out of the big fellas now were jumping out of the top windows of the office. You took your life in your hand if you walked down Wall Street. These people that sent me out to Chicago to do a nodded of a huge iron and coal mine, people that had their head office in Chicago, and I traveled between there and Nebraska over a period of nearly 6 months there, but I used to travel. But I had to go to get certain information. I went to the thing. So I used to stay in the Drake Hotel, all magnificent hotel there, on the bay, you see. And I used to get into a lot of kind of trouble. You know what I mean? One time I was out in the. Al Capone's place in Cicero, and I got playing poker, and I won a hell of a lot of money, and I didn't know how, in the name of God, I was going to get out of it, because you thought from all you were reading in the papers and everything else, that anyone like that appeared, that you're a bloody well shot, you got out of the thing. But I, to tell you the honest truth, I won about $3,000, and that was a lot of money in those days, you see. And I wanted to get home, and I was frightened, and I didn't know what the hell to do. So I said to the fellas, well, I'm off, and I got up and walked away from the table. And one fellow said, hey, what about your money? I said, you can keep it. They said, what do you mean? Look, said I want to get to the door. I want to get a taxi, and I want to get home. I don't want the money. They stuffed it in my pockets, put me in the taxi, and sent me to Drake Hotel. That was the biggest surprise I ever had in my life, to tell you the honest truth.
Just you wait and see.
I've stayed outside, just outside London, in a place. And anyway, one night I was sitting in the sitting room reading, do you see, and in a big chair like this. And of course, I never bothered to go out when the raids were on. I did. Where the hell was there to go? You're out in the street, you might as well stay where you are, do you see? And I heard this plane coming. There was a raid on anyway. Oh, it was just... Now I was waiting, I guess. It was near Battersea. All the time they were trying to get the big electricity station at Battersea. Now, anyway, I heard the first bomb dropped, you see. Used to count and drop in threes. You know, everything got mechanical. You know, after a while they dropped three bombs, one, two, three, at intervals of seconds, do you see, and then they'll go on to drop another three bombs, do you see. They never came in and just bombed the whole blasted place with about 20 or 30 planes. But they were doing this to try and get Battersea Park, do you see. Anyway, the second bomb came down, I heard it, and the third one, I heard it coming, I said, this is it. And it was. Right into the basement of the house. Blew me all over the... I was in this chair and turned all over the place. The bloody house fell down on me. And I crawled to the... I could see a light. There's a light out the window there. And I crawled to that. And it was a window. And it was... about the same depth down to the basement, and I jumped out of it, and I was in rags practically. So I went over to a pub there, and when the fella saw me, he said, "What happened?" I said, "I just was hit with a bomb has hit the house." Well, he says, "Come on in." He said, "I'll give you a couple of jars." And he was awfully nice to me. He allowed me to stay there. For about 3 weeks, till I got myself fixed up, do you see? And then I had no money, and I couldn't get in touch with Dublin. And I was going around with literally naked. So somebody told me, go down to the county council, it was down the road a bit, and tell them your story. And I went down, and I was interviewed, frightfully decent. They gave me vouchers to get clothes, And they gave me a £10 note. See? And after I got the clothes and the £10 note, I was ready to back for work again, you see. The Japs used to attack us every morning. And there was a most extraordinary thing about them, that they always came at 10 o'clock. They never varied the times. They didn't say 9:30, 9:45, 10, 9:45 or anything like that. 10 o'clock on the moment they came over, you see. And they bombed Nisun. Well, I used to get fed up. Now, this isn't my own personal thing you can do. I used to get fed up every morning at 10 o'clock, the damn bastards coming over and running down into the Ula, which was the rubber plantations all round us. And lying there for about half an hour until you heard them all going back. And then you didn't bother your neck about a thing, you see, until the next morning. It was an Australian station, you see. And I was the RAF accountant. And the Australians had to get all money from me. Not from Australia never supplied any money. It was all supplied by the Air Force. And of course, when I was sent there, I was an account was opened in the Imperial Bank, in which I could draw as much money as I wanted to. See, so they used to come to me on certain days and say they wanted £30,000, £40,000, or £50,000. It didn't any matter. I said, "All right, I'll have it for you." I'd drive into town, you see, draw the money, hand it to the chief accountant officer of the Australians, get him to sign for it, and that's all I bloody well ever did. So then I got a bit cute. I said to myself, why the bloody hell should I be here at 10 o'clock every bloody morning when the Japs had come over and bombed the bloody station? So at 10 minutes to 10, I got into my car and I drove to town. I arrived in town just at 10 o'clock and down into the vaults of the bank, which was, you see? And after that, you see, when it was all over, about 10:30, we'd all come up again, the bank door had opened and everything. And it was a most extraordinary thing. I lost none of my men out of the station, but that didn't make any difference. In the meantime, I'd got word that there was an evacuation was going to take place. So I went down to the station the next morning, do you see? And I got on the wrong train. But it was the right train for me. It was to a little sugar port called Chili Jap. And when we got to Chili Jap, there was a freighter there, I suppose about 4,000 tons, and we were all pushed onto this freighter. And of course, there was only six or seven cabins in it, so you slept in the decks, you slept on anything, it didn't matter a damn what you do, slept on. And at this time, I had acquired seven suitcases of money. So I put them out on the deck, you see, and I used to sleep on them. But there was only enough water on the ship for one cupful of water each a day. There was 4,500 of us on it. And there was nothing to serve food in it. So when the fella came round with a tin of kind of stew, and he said, open your hand, and he put a spoonful of food in your hand, you eat it out of that. And that happened for 11 days until we got to India. Well, of course, we were all so dirty and everything that I don't mind telling you, when I took my clothes off, with sweat and dirt and everything, threw them over the ship's side, that they sank to the bottom. But anyway, I went up to the accountant officer there, and I had these seven bags of suitcases of money. And of course, the boys on the ships had nothing. And they wanted to get ashore, you know, after 11 days at sea. And I asked him for 300,000 rupees. And he said to me, where the hell would I get 300,000 rupees? I says, in the bank, of course. But he says, I haven't got 300,000 rupees in the bank. So I called four fellas in. And I said, here, boys, come in. And there's a big table there. I said, put those cases on the table. And I said, open them up so as he can have a look at them. And I said, I don't know how much is in this. Nor I don't care either, as far as I'm concerned. I said, I want 300,000 rupees for this, for the crew and the members of the Air Force. Oh, he says, I can't do that. You'll have to count it. I turned around and I says to him, I've been 11 days at sea. And each day I got a handful of muck to eat. I'm going out now to buy the biggest bloody steak I can find in Ceylon. And I said, when I come back, I want 300,000 rupees. I says, you count the fucking lot. Another trip to America. We went to Cleveland. I liked Cleveland, so I did. It wasn't as terrible big as the usual American towns. But of course, it had the chief thing, and it was outside Cleveland was the Ford Motor Works, and that they were so big that when you went to a visitor went there, they gave him a little car to drive all around it. Yes, there was a straight mile in it. And you got this little buggy car and you drove all around it. And I was in many of the big factories there in Cleveland. They had those things for, in which to go around. Motor car engine places. All the big motor cars had built their engines there, you see. And that's why you got these colossal factories. The rest of the places, you know, there'd be small factories, but they're only assembly joints, you see, because the cars went out in a crate. The whole car went out in a crate, you see, to say Joe Doug, and he took the wood off the crate and he assembled the car by putting the wheels and everything on it. I was a travelling auditor in the Auditor Bureau of Circulations. Do you know, do you ever hear of that place? Auditor Newspaper Circulation. Well, I was in that, and I was travelling. Oh, I used to travel all over the place, you know, the small papers, you do the audit, you'd be 2 days there. And of course, I had the wife and the two children with me, and I couldn't bring them along. So I got a place outside a parish house outside Philadelphia for them. It was on the seashore, about 12 miles out. And on the horizon was the ships. But I used to go down there every weekend. And all the wife always had me a bottle of whiskey. I think I mentioned that before. After that, I came home. There was a depression on in America, with no use of me remaining there. And I came home, and I've been home ever since.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.